Hi, everybody. My name's Earl. I'm an alcoholic. I'd start off by defending myself. I got a call one day from a guy who said, is your name Earl Hightower? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you're on a long-distance directory somewhere that with your old phone number. I think I have your old phone number. Because I get a lot of phone calls from alcoholic people. I said, I'm really sorry, man. Just if you know anything about the directory, I'll call him and I'll straighten it out. And I did. So it wasn't me. Anyway, thank you for asking me to come here and do this. It's always an honor and a privilege to participate in an event like this, be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you to the committee. Thanks, Jerry, for keeping an eye on me, picking me up. My original sponsor, the late, great Donald Madden, at one point turned to me and said, you should never be allowed to walk the earth unattended. So I don't. It's always good to have a keeper when I go places. It keeps an eye on me and makes sure I'm where I'm supposed to be. I got a little freaked out, you know, this before, and then I remembered why I'm here. And I love the countdown. That was incredible. Welcome. 2 days. Yeah, you. Welcome. Yeah. 55 days short of 53 years. Thank you for being the light up ahead. You know? You as well, young lady. Thank you for the same. And all you people that stood up, that have been sober longer than me, thank you for keeping coming back, man. Going to meetings, showing up, letting us know that there is a way for people like us, you know, to live happy, joyous, and free. That it's not just words on a page. You know, that the big book does come alive, you know, and it's in rooms like this and people like you that make that, a living truth. So anyway, I guess I should talk about drinking. Apparently there's been a significant amount of that going on in Atlanta. Jeez. I didn't start drinking until I was 12. I waited as long as I possibly could, man. I had been restless, irritable, and discontented for quite some time prior to, and I didn't have a childhood, so I don't have much to say about, you know, being a little one. I don't remember much of it. I come from a very violent home. My father was psychologically and physically extremely abusive. I'm Earl Hightower Jr. I am an extension of the man, and I was going to be all the things that he was not if it killed me by his hand, right? And he was a man who never should have been a parent. Do you know what I mean? There's just some people that should have their parenting license revoked, you know? when you don't have a childhood, what you have is you have snapshots, and there's a lot of people in here that I know what I'm talking about. You just have little pictures, little freeze frames of when you were a little kid, right? Some of the more interesting moments, shall we say, that took place along the way. And I remember walking down this hallway. I was 4 years old. I was already sipping on daddy's beer. I hadn't gotten drunk yet, but I'd been tasting alcohol, you know, since I could reach up and get a hold of the can with both hands and take a slug, right? And I was walking down a hallway with my father, and he had his arm on my shoulder, which was weird right there, because we didn't touch each other. We weren't, you know, we fought and we shook hands. That's it. You know, there was no, you know, hugging it up. You know what I mean? So, and he had his hand on my shoulder, and we're walking down, and I'm 4 and troubled by this, that he has his hand on my shoulder. It's like, you know, where are we walking me to? You know what? You know? Is this going to be like right out the front door and then I hear it slam behind me? What's going on? And we were walking along and he said, you know, you're going to be a man soon. And I was 4. And I remember looking up at him and thinking, I don't think that's right. Is anybody here in charge around here? This guy's crazy. And it was just pandemonium, right? And, you know, by I was a kid. You took your eyes off me. I disappeared. You know what I mean? I was taken off all the time. And they did a bunch of tests on me and stuff. You know, I was constantly being assessed because I was this just strange little kid, right? And I ended up in this boarding school. I'm going to bypass all the craziness that went on, but... Don't worry, there's plenty of crazy to come. Don't worry. I got crazy on top of crazy. I got. I said, I'm going to skip that crazy. She went, oh. I like the crazy. I'll get you some crazy. So they said, what happened was there was this boarding school, it was a think tank. There's a guy in here who went to Webb School for Boys from Bell Buckle, Tennessee. Where are you? Right over there? I'll tell you from personal experience, those two guys are miracles that they're alive. Because that's a school that's basically, we will educate you or we will beat you to death. I think it's on the crest of the school. a diploma and a child being bludgeoned. It's on the crest. It's nuts, right? And I was the West Coast campus, right, in Claremont, California, Webb School for Boys. And there were, it was called the Great Experiment that they had done this global exam. It was 5.5-hour exam that they took, and they were going to have the first 8th graders, right? It was 9th through 12th grade, as you guys know. Right? I'm talking to these two guys, right? I'll get with you guys in a minute. There was, and 16 people passed the test in the world. Wow. Right? And how I found out I was going to the Webb School for Boys was my father came in my room and said, get in the car! All right. You know, apparently this is going to all end off-site. Right? So that, I go outside and there's a couple of cars running. There's relatives in there that I don't even know. You know what I mean? People I've never met. That's your cousin Darlene. Okay. You know? So we go and we drive and we get to this place and I get out of the car. My father gets out of the car and nobody else gets out of the car. They don't even turn the cars off. Motor's running. He gets out, puts a suitcase down next to me, sticks it out of his hand, says, this will make a man out of you. Gets back in the car and they all took off, right? Turns out, I'm the youngest and smallest kid in the school of 250 boys. There's 249 teenagers and one 12-year-old, me. I'm 5 feet tall, 103 pounds. Again, manhood just around the corner. Right? You know, 8 years later, still incorrect, Dad. And, I mean, I've just been thrown away by the people who know me best in the world. That's the emotional experience that I'm having. So why are you throwing me away like this? What did I do? Right? I was devastated by this. And I called home, you know, now the fact is I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education. Held me in good stead to this very day. But I'm not a facts guy. I'm a feelings guy. If it is bad, if it feels bad, it is bad. I don't like this, what's happening, right? So I'm wandering around this campus, scared of my own shadow, trying not to make eye contact with anybody, right? And I meet Tiny. Every high school has a guy named Tiny. He's like 6'4", 240, plays guard on the football team, right? And he's found me, and I'm like the new kid. And it's just that, you know, it was no big deal. It was just, oh, look, the new kid. And he goes, how you doing, punk? And he slapped me in the back of the head and just sent me flying in the quad, you know, in front of everybody, right? Books flying. I'm all sprawled out, right? Everybody goes, Tiny walloped the little guy, right? And Tiny just thought he smacked little kid, right? He didn't realize he had just struck someone who was willing to die over this. Just a little different personality than most, right? So I just quietly got up and walked over and belted Tiny as hard as I possibly could. Now, Rich knocked his dude out, right, with the sucker punch, right? To which I say, well played, sir. Right? I walked straight up to a giant and walloped him with everything I had and then just stood there. You know, if I could have expressed what I was feeling, I would have said to him, hey, listen, Tiny, I'm way past anything I'm familiar with in any way whatsoever. You know, you're going to have to take it from here, bro. Which he looked in, he looked at him, and he said, you got a lot of guts, kid. And then he beat the crap out of me, right? And as I'm taking the beating, I'm thinking, you know, this is going pretty good, right? Because I know how to take a beating. I know all about that, right? But, you know, I'm not taking that off anybody. You're going to kill me, but I'm not taking it. Sorry. Right? It's nothing to think about. And I kept getting up, and he kept knocking me down, and I kept getting up, and he kept knocking me down. And it started to get embarrassing for Tiny. It was embarrassing. Everybody was like, dude, just stay down, man. You know? And I'm just like, nope. My face isn't finished with you yet. Bam! Till finally, I'm out. You know, it's over. And Tiny's feeling bad. I mean, we became friends, right? Because Tiny felt really bad about it. It wasn't his intention to have to beat a kid after death. You know, he was just messing around with the new guy, right? So I go back to my dorm room. I'm waiting for the bleeding to stop. You know what I mean? Sitting there thinking, you know, life is good. I'm enjoying life. You know, and word spreads around this campus like wildfire. Watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacked Tiny, right? which has nothing to do with who I am. I'm a frightened child, right? But, you know, nope, maniac on campus, right? So the cool guys come around, and Matt sticks his head in the dorm room, and he says, you want to smoke a joint? And I said, yes, I do. Had no idea what that meant. I had no idea what he was talking about. Didn't matter. What I heard was, do you want to come with us? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. We're going to go kill the Spanish teacher. Okay. They got me in Latin. I don't care. Right? So we pick up Steve. Steve has a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine. And I mean, no grapes involved, red wine, you know what I mean? A little night train, a little mad dog, whatever, you know what I mean? And we get behind the dorm, two 13-year-olds and a 12-year-old, right? And Matt fires up the joint, takes a hit, and hands it to me. And I don't know how this happens. I've been talking about this lately, but I don't understand this at all. I think it's DNA. I think that there's drug DNA. I do. I think that there's drug abuse DNA. Because when you know how you take a joint from somebody, you just, it's two moves in one. You know what I mean? You throw out the index finger and you hit the back of the joint and then you clip with the thumb and it's just like a whap, you know, and you have it. Right? Now, nobody taught me that. I did not know where I learned to do that, but Matt took the joint out and I just went, oh, swap. Took a hit off that, it burned my lungs, and I thought, no, that's nasty. And then the wine came over and I took a pull on that wine, and that, oh, that mix of chemicals rolled down, hit the bottom of my stomach and just that, and wafted back up, you know, like it does where you just kind of go, like, what have I just done to myself, right? And I thought, that is horrible. Let's get that joint back over here. You know, and it's three total strangers, babies, standing by an oak tree, you know, smoking a joint and drinking some cheap red wine. The magic happened. That thing that makes me bodily and mentally different from my fellows occurred, and suddenly I'm comfortable standing where I'm standing, doing what I'm doing with the people I'm doing it with. And I never felt like that before in my life. I exhaled fully and completely for the first time in my life. Just, I didn't know that would also be the last time I would do that. But it was the first time that I felt that complete sense of ease and contentment, you know, that we seek, right? And I don't know, is it the pot? Is it the wine? Is it my two very close personal friends, Matt and Steve? Because these are my boys, you know what I mean? I'm feeling this, right? And I don't care, you know? I mean, you know, the knots on my head, I'm not worried about Tiny, you know what I mean? I ain't afraid of Tiny. You know, you want to give it another roll, Tiny? Let's fire it up, big man. Let's go. You know? It's all good. It's just suddenly all good. And I go to bed that night, I woke up the next morning and my first thought was, where are Matt and Steve? I got to find Matt and Steve. No hesitation. You know, people walking up going, hey, you the new kid? Yeah. You know a guy named Steve? The new kid looks like he's blind in one eye and he wants to know where a guy named Matt is. And I found him and I did, next 16 years I drank and used no matter what. Given a good reason, I did not stop. That is the difference between me and the problem drinker. Given a good reason, I do not stop. I don't touch the brakes, right? I just keep going. You might go to jail. That would be upsetting. I would really prefer that didn't happen, but you know. I remember the first time I got shot at. We don't need to talk about that. I don't even know why I brought that up. You have no idea what's going on in here right now. It's very strange to be one person up here talking to however many of you there are in this place. How many people are in here? A lot of you. Those are not good odds. Right? So anyway, humble beginnings, pot and wine. You know, 13 was pills. The only reason I took a pill is I was on a 10-hour pass, and the guy said, would you like a pill? And I said, yes, I would. And he had two pills in his hand. I took them and I swallowed them. And I said, what were those? Which is what we do, right? The normal man will say, before I put this in my mouth, could I get a little rundown on what we got going on here? You know? I just threw them in my mouth and thought, you know, listen, should I like lay down now or get ready to paint the house? What? What are we doing here? And the dude said, you should lay down. I went, oh, all right. He was correct. 2-0. Oh, yeah, I like this crowd. Identifying, but you all know there's only one reason to take a 2-0, and that's if you have a medical need to melt. All they're good for. So I got strung out on 2-0, 2-0, Placidale, all the barbiturates, you know, all that stuff, you know, just horrific stuff, right? That was 13, 14 with psychedelics. The only reason I took a psychedelic is I was on a pass from, on a 10-hour pass from boarding school with a girl named Debbie. Very bad girl. I will love her till the day I die. Fantastic human being. Talk about knowing how to share. And she said, she said, you want to drop some acid? And I said, of course I do, Debbie. Again, no idea what we're talking about, right? She took a lipstick tube and spun it up, and there's a little pill on the end of the lipstick, which I thought was very clever, right? So I just took it off and popped it in my mouth, and she said, did you just take that whole thing? And I said, well, yeah, it was a very tiny pill. I'm used to these 3 grand, you know, these big old horse caps, you know, these barbiturates. And she said, that was 3 hits of white lightning. Again, this room, what the hell's going on? This is not a usual response. Anyways, obviously, you know that the next 2 days were very interesting for me. 650 hits later, I got classified legally insane by the military, but that's a whole story we don't have time for here. 15, I started shooting dope. And the only reason I shot dope, now, understand I said my name's Earl and I'm an alcoholic. I identify as an alcoholic. And the reason I identify as an alcoholic is because alcohol is what got me here. Now, and understand this. I'm a child of the 60s. I'm just telling you the truth, right? I'm a child of the 60s. We were very focused on the drugs. Our parents were the alcoholics. We were carving out our own identity. We were going to kill ourselves in a whole new way, right? But the fact of the matter is, the truth for me is that the drugs would come and go. The only thing that was on the table every single day was alcohol. Booze was king in my world, right? And the reason for that, I think, is very simple. This is my opinion. These drugs are completely unreliable. They are. You don't know what you got till you get it in your body. I never been to the connection and had the, said like an eight ball, please, and had the guy say, you know what? It's not really that good this week. Come back next week. We'll try to have something a little better caliber for you. Never happened. Never happened. You know what I mean? So, but you get yourself a quart of Jack Daniels, you get a fifth of good gin, you know what you got here. This is reliable stuff. You can count on it. So you do so much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore. Right? Right? And it's 7 p.m. and the party just started and you've completely overshot the mark one more time. You know what I mean? It's cool. Get the Jack, suck a little Jack through your teeth, shake it off. You can go on with the party. You're going to be all right. Acid a little too spooky, suck that gin down, boy. It'll get you back in the comfort zone. You'll be all right. Right? Booze is reliable, right? So, we were focused on the drug. I was a hippie, long hair, all that stuff, right? But alcohol had become my best friend right from the gate, right? So 15, I started shooting dope. And the only reason I shot dope is I was on a boat in Marina Del Rey with a girl named Cammie. Lovely girl. Would not want to cast dispersions upon those that were around me at the time, right? And Cammie said, would you like me to stick this in your body? And I said, I am certain of it, Cammie. And Cammie did, and it was one of those shots where you just go, right? And on the way down, all I was thinking was, if I'm not dead, I am doing that again, because that was amazing, right? So, my coloring box was growing by leaps and bounds. You know what I mean? I had alcohol in this thing and alcohol in this thing and alcohol in this thing, alcohol in this thing. And everything I was doing was in relation to alcohol. You do lots of this, you can drink more. You do lots of this, you got to kind of cut back on the alcohol. You got to do this. It was all this balancing act. You know what I mean? Cocaine and Quaaludes. I'm a Quaalude era guy, right? I love this, right? Fans of the Quaalude era. Roar 714s. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my God. For all you pure alcoholics out there, I don't imagine there's a whole lot of you, but if for you pure alcoholics, don't worry about this nonsense. We're just talking about a very brief, vaguely remembered era. Right? Quaaludes had a special purpose and a special value. I'll be happy to tell you about after the meeting. Right? But that, cocaine and Quaaludes for me, that was just, I wasn't getting high. That was just relaxed but alert, Just trying to stay calm, but focused, Up and down at the same time, walking that fence. That was the thing, Get some more alcohol in, get some more alcohol, get some more of that powdered stuff going again. Oh, a little much, get the alcohol going again. Never quite hitting that mark, That's how you come to in different cities. Right? What were you doing? Minding my own business in my living room, just trying to hit the line. That's all I was trying to do, man. Well, how'd you end up in Oakland? I do not know. No. Do you know someone in Oakland we can call? I'm afraid I do not. That sort of stuff going on, right? 16, I dropped out of high school. You know, 4.5 years of Latin was enough. Then my father said, you've gone nuts. They threw me in my first mental institution. Took me a while to talk my way out of there, hit the streets doing what we do on a daily basis, threw the net over me again. I escaped the first day because I learned, you know, on my first trip to the nut house that you got to get out before they get the Thorazine in you or you're leaving when they say, you know, because Thorazine got two speeds, slow and stopped. That's it. Right? So I busted out of that joint. Right? I have since done business. I did 16 years after I escaped from the Westwood in West L.A., California. I went back and did business, and the same administrator was there. And I'm in this guy's office trying to do a little business, right? And on more than one occasion, he said to me, you know, your name's familiar. And I went, yeah, it's that kind of name. And I kept thinking in the back of my head was, practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, practice these principles in all our affairs. You know what I mean? I'm lying to this guy. I'm starting to get uncomfortable. You know what I mean? And he's this really nice guy. And we're doing this thing. And he's, yeah, I'll help you out, kid. You know, we'll do some business. It'll be good. We'll get you started. Your career started. He's being really super nice to me, right? And he's walking me out. And we're talking. And he's, you know, stuff. And I said, listen, I got to be honest with you. He goes, well, whatever do you mean, young man? And I said, well, I escaped from here 16 years ago. And there was this rather brief pause, you know, and he looked at me and he said, well, you seem to be doing pretty good. I said, yeah, I am, thanks. We shook hands and I went back and I go, you're never going to guess, we're doing business with the psych unit that I escaped from. And they said, say what now? Yes, you have an escaped mental patient on your as an employee of your facility. Yes. So anyway, so we went on and on, hit the street, spent 3 years out on the street. A lot of weird things happened, you know. We all got crazy stories, right? You know, there were a few very intense moments. You know, and I ended up in business college. Long story, right? End up in business college. I'm a drug dealer now. And I'm a drug dealer because I have no morals, I have no ethics, I have no sense of family, I have no sense of community. I'm just loose, right? So nothing, in my mind, there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a drug dealer. It's just the only thing I know anything about, right? But I'm going to college now, so I'm studying marketing, production, distribution. I'm applying it to my business. Business is booming. These guys seem to know what they're talking about, you know what I mean? So I'm going to college saying, this is pretty good, right? And they have a health fair. And some of my running buddies said, let's go to the health fair, right? So we get as high as we possibly can and go to the health fair, right? And they're checking us all out, and I get singled out. And they tell me, you should see a doctor. And I went, well, all right. I thought that's what you were. Right. And then, no, you go see this guy. So I went and I see this guy and he checks me and he goes, you have malignant cancer. And I said, great. Right. Wasn't expecting to hear that, but okay. So what do we do about that? Right. Because I'm having a really good time right now and I wouldn't want anything to interfere with that. And he said, well, you know, you got to do surgery and there's a doctor in L.A. And right. So they fly me back to L.A. and they tell me I got to get my affairs in order because it's not looking like I'm going to make it. Right. And that was the first time I was 19, 20, somewhere in there, 20 years old. And it was the first time in my life somebody said something to me that really stood me back, you know, just took me back a bit. It was like, what? He said, you should really think about getting your affairs in order. And I thought, oh. So I started to think about that and I thought, you know what? I don't have any of those. You know, I've been here 20 years and I got nothing to show for it. Nothing. I haven't done anything, right? Except just rapidly move forward like this wounded animal, right? And not knowing how to really be in the world, not being any good at dealing with other people, not, you know, always looking over my shoulder, not being able to trust anybody, not being able to have any kind of real intimacy or any real relationships of any significance in my life. Just kind of this loose guy, you know what I mean? Running amok, right? So I'd go to L.A. and they do major surgery on my upper back, you know what I mean? And they put me in the nuclear medicine program. It's called chemotherapy now. It's called nuclear medicine back then, right? And there, I wouldn't go in the room and do the whole thing. I'd make them come out in the hall and shoot me up, right? So I'd stand out in the hall and they'd hit me up and they'd go, you know, it'd be a lot better if you'd go. And I'd go, you know, it'd be a lot better if I didn't come here at all. Is what it would be a lot better. So after a few trips, I thought, you guys' drugs suck, right? So I left and went home the way that, and get loaded the way I get loaded, right? And I beat the cancer. I'm a long-term cancer survivor, right? And my friends used to say, they said, Earl, at the time your body was so toxic, cancer could not live in your body. That's how bad it was. And I was like, yeah, well, maybe so. I don't know. And I kept moving along. And then my mother called me. I'm 21, 22 coming up. My mother calls me. You know, and I've been estranged from my family for 10 years. I haven't gone home in 10 years, right, for more than a few hours, because that's all it took for me and my father to be up and at each other, right? And by the time I was 16, you know, he wasn't coming at me like that anymore, because I'd been, you know, playing football and lifting weights and, you know, fighting all the time, you know what I mean? And it got to the point where I knew, you know, if you come at me, old man, you know, it's going to be the last time you come at anybody, right? And this little spark went between us, and I stood up and just said, you know, let's do it, right? I'm going to give it all back to you today. And he didn't get up. He stayed in his chair. And that was the last time my father put his hands on me. But my mother started crying on the phone and said, we got to put this family back together. You guys got to put this stuff between you aside. You got to deal with this, right? Because there's a love and respect between you two that you don't seem to be able to get to. There's too much anger, too much animosity. You're just too short a fuse on both sides of this equation. And we got to get past this. And that's what you're going to do, because that's what I'm telling you you're going to do, right? Because who ultimately ran the family was her, right? And she was letting us know that at that particular moment. And so I just said, yes, ma'am, right? Now I got hair down on my elbows. You know, I'm strung out like a dog. You know, I've gotten an early acceptance to USC Law School. My life's shooting in two directions, you know, just moving further and further apart from one another, right? So I fly back to L.A. on my 22nd birthday, and we get in my father's plane to fly to Guadalajara to celebrate my 22nd birthday. And on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister all died in the crash. And I survived, in a way. And I woke up in the wreckage, and my skull was broken, and my back was broken in three places, leg crushed, arm crushed, a lot of internal injuries, paralyzed from the waist down. Only thing I could move was my right arm, and I was awake. And I didn't know that I was paralyzed. I was still in the seat. My seat had been ripped out of the plane, right? And I unbuckled my seatbelt, and it just fell out in the dirt. And my mother was laying right over there, and my little sister Kimberly was right over there, and my father was right over there. And I couldn't get to any of them to help them. I couldn't do anything about what was happening. So I laid there, and I watched them all bleed to death in front of me. And I just had this real quiet moment where I just said, you know what? I renounce God. I have no use for a God of this type. Anybody who'd take a kind, gentle, loving, poetic creature like my little sister Kimberly, leave a lying, cheating, thieving, dope fiend, alcoholic like me on the planet, I got no use for God this time. I renounce God. Then some guys came up after a while and they scavenged the wreck and they took everything they could find of any value and they left and left me up there to die. So I had no more love for you either. No love of God, no love of my fellow man. Some guys finally came up and got me and threw me in the back of a flatbed truck next to my mother. And I held my dead mother's hand and we went to a Mexican aid station. They tagged her dead. They tagged me dead and they sat there smoking cigarettes waiting for me to die. I wouldn't. Finally took me to a place called Los Mochis Hospital in Hospital Fatima in Los Mochis, Mexico. And I guess I died there and then they brought me back. Because I remember coming to and a bunch of people started yelling in Spanish and sticking things in me, which was not really appreciated at the moment. Right? And because I was back and I thought, still here, you know? God was sure that was it, man. When that plane was heading for Earth, I thought, there's no way you come. I mean, this is, and bing, eyes open, right? And they plaster me from the neck down. The Federales get a hold of my name. They show up and interrogate me for 3.5 days, torture me for 3.5 days, wanted to know what I'm doing back in Mexico. We had a little issue with me being in Mexico. They were not thrilled to see me, and were real serious about wanting to know what I was doing there, and I wouldn't tell them. So I finally called some dudes up in Northern California who flew a plane in and paid a bunch of guys off. They plastered me from the neck down and smuggled me out of Mexico. I spent a long time in a hospital in Santa Monica, California, St. John's Hospital. Came out of there as crazy as I've ever been in my life, man. I had pictures in my head I knew I couldn't live with. I was all crippled up. I've been getting maximum doses of Demerol every 3 hours around the clock for a long time. So I knew when they discharged me, I had 3 hours to connect, man, or I was going to start kicking like a dog, right? Luckily, the guys that picked me up were ready to rock, right? So they picked me up, man. I was high before I got out of that parking lot. And I went on my last run, and it lasted for 6 years. Oh, my back, man, is just jacked. Sorry. If I just go over, just get up here and prop me back up. I'm fine. It ain't no big deal. It's what I live with. You don't know it looking at me by the way I walk around, but I'm 100% disabled. I'm handicapped, right? They said I should have been in a wheelchair long before now, right? And I'm not. You know why? Because I love life. And I love being in it, and I refuse. I fight every day, man, to be in the game, to be in life. You know? I can't stand for an hour, but I stand for an hour. I can't get out and shake people's hands for another hour, but I do it. And I do it because without you, I got nothing. Nothing. You know? I'm a faint memory from long, long ago. That's all I am, right? I owe you everything I've got, so that's what you get. You get everything I got. Right? So I did that 6 years, and at the end of that 6 years, I've been shot at a few times. I've been stabbed twice. I've broken 74 bones. I mean, when I came out of my last blackout, I had hair down on my elbows. I was 215 pounds. I was yellow. My thyroid had ceased to function. My heart, the sac around my heart was swollen. My kidneys and my liver were so angry. Just, you know, it was a multi-systemic failure, you know. Organ failure was going on. I was dying of alcoholism. I'd broken 74 bones. The cops were outside deciding whether or not to charge me with the attempted murder of David Luboff. There was an ambulance and a police car outside, and they didn't know which one to put me in. I'd broken 74 bones. I had no friends. I had no place to live. You know, I wasn't suicidal, but I was drinking and using in a way that if it killed me, it killed me. It was an acceptable consequence to the way I used. Right? And I was telling some people earlier on, my moment of clarity happened in a blackout. I don't know what it was. I'm a lightning bolt through the window guy. I started drinking one day just because that's what I do. I'm just drinking, right? When I say I started drinking one day, it's that I'd been drinking earlier in the day and stopped momentarily and had begun drinking again that day. All right? And came out of a blackout 4 days later and it was over. I don't know what happened in that 4 day blackout. But I came out of the blackout, both my hands were busted. David Luboff's outside yelling, "You don't understand the ramifications of the situation." That's a quote. "You don't understand the ramifications of the situation." And I remember thinking, he is correct. I don't. And I just went, "Help." And somebody in the room knew what had just happened when I said help. And they went, "Throw him in the ambulance." And they threw me in the ambulance and off I went before the cops knew what was happening. They pumped my stomach at UCLA emergency room. And then they took me to Olive View Medical Center for 5 days and I got worse. And they took me from there by ambulance down to Long Beach General Hospital under the care of a Dr. Vicky Fox, who saved countless worthless souls like mine. And I was in a room that was 42 old army cots in one room, 21 cots on each side of the room with sheets drawn between the cots. And how you kicked was called riding the cot. Now, I'd been running and gunning for 6 years, right? Shooting heroin, drinking, taking pills, all you name it, man. I was just saturated. And I jumped in that cot and just said, "I'm going to live or die right here. This is it. This cot's mine." And I spent 42 days in that cot. bucked up out of there twice, couple seizures. If you've ever had a seizure, I'm sure a lot of you have had a seizure. You all know that the only thing you remember about a seizure is that suddenly you don't feel real well, and then you're waking up. And that middle part, you everybody else is familiar with, but you miss, right? It's just sort of this, uh-oh, what happened? Well, you just bucked right up out of the cart and were flopping around on the floor, right? So we took you in, shot you full anticonvulsant, stabilized you, got your heart rate down to about 175 over 85. Figured that's good enough, and then rolled him back into the room, and you're just in the cot, riding that cot, man, hanging on those rails. So a total of 52 days of detox, and Ray W. said to me, if you don't want to die, you better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place a guy like you has a shot. And I said, well, that's rude. But okay. So I ended up in the basement of a church on a Friday night, Tri-God meeting. There's a lady in here tonight who was with the Tri-God group. There she is right there, right? We're from the same neighborhood. I got a couple more months than you, right? We're in about the same amount of time, right? And Jeannie and Nick, you know, heard Chuck C. talk and guys like that in that meeting, you know, and it just crazy as crazy can be, man. Walking in that door, hair out like this, mad dogging everybody. Do not come up on me. Oh, do not confuse me with somebody that wants to hear about your day. I don't care about your day. Well, you never guess what happened today. Oh, well, I guess I don't care what happened today. I don't care. You're not very friendly. No, I don't like you. You're over there. I don't like anyone over there. I don't like anybody. Stay away from me. I don't want to chit-chat. I've seen you chit-chat. I don't like the chit-chatting. No chit-chatting. I don't have the answers to your chit-chatting. I don't like your chit-chatting questions. It's all questions. It's like a pop quiz from total strangers. What's up? I do not know. What's going on? Don't know. How you doing? Beats me. You're just really starting to piss me off, though. That's all I know. I'm not liking you at all. It was just the way it was. You know what I mean? I didn't know how to be in the world. I didn't know how to be with you. The old timers were great. I walk in the back of the meeting growling, you know. I mean, there's one lady who saw me come in. And she's, people were all my sponsees and all these guys who knew me and stuff. You're like, Mr. Speaker Boy and blah, 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 right? What was he like when he got here? And they would go up to Roz and go, what was he like when he got here? And she doesn't even use words. She just goes, oh. Oh. Because and she says how angry I was. She tells them how angry I was. And the truth is that's how terrified I was. I was masked by the anger. I was just terrified. I was like glass. I wasn't worried if you came up on me, you were going to get hurt. I was afraid that you were going to come up on me and I was just going to shatter. And I had no place else to go. So I couldn't talk to you. I couldn't tell you what I'd done, the things that I had done, what I had been up to, because you looked like reasonable people, and reasonable people would ask me to leave if they heard what I had done. So I couldn't tell you the truth. So I didn't say a word in Alcoholics Anonymous for 2.5 years. Not a word. I got a sponsor. They said, get a sponsor. And I said, what's that? I said, somebody's got what you want. And I said, well, I would like to drink. And they said, no, get somebody. You know, what I believe today is that if you go get a sponsor who's got what he wants or she wants, that's a good definition of happiness, wanting what you have, right? So I saw this guy when I'm in a meeting one day in the back, arms folded, mad dog, and everybody, and this guy comes flying in the room. And I mean flying into the room, right? The kind of guy that, like, if you walk through that door right now, everybody in the room would turn and look and go, hey, who's the big gay guy, right? I mean, very flamboyant gay man. He's the late, great Donald Madden. And he got up at the podium and he shared his experience, strength, and hope. And he tore the roof off that joint. He was so proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't care what anybody thought about him or how he lived his life or what he did or anything. He loved AA, and he was going to tell you about how wonderful AA was and what it did for an alcoholic. That nothing else could do for an alcoholic. AA could do what nothing else could do. Bring an alcoholic back into the world. Bring them back to life. Bring them out of a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Right? And he did it with this passion and this dignity and this grace. And he sat down and I went, that. I want that. And these dudes sitting next to me were like, you've been paying attention, dude? And I said, yeah, I've been paying attention. And that guy is passionate. That guy loves his life. That guy feels passionately about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm dead inside. I want to feel strongly about something. And that guy does. I want that. So I walked up to him and I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, yes. And you don't have to like it. You don't have to think it's a good idea. You just have to do it, baby. And I said, okay. Having no idea what I had just agreed to. And I did everything that man, I called him every day, and I did everything that man told me to do, and he told me what to do every single day for almost 14 years up until the day he died. And he saved my life. I'm here because of the late, great Donald Madden. He was Alcoholics Anonymous to me. He was the only human being I trusted until he made me go talk to Christopher, who I knew was wearing as crazy as I was. And I said, I'll go talk to Christopher, but it ain't going to go well. And he said, oh, it'll go how it'll go. Go talk to Christopher. Christopher just celebrated 40 years in March. I'm the godfather to his two daughters, and we've been friends from that day to this. That's Donald Madden. I became homicidal in recovery, like legit homicidal, right? Like I'm going to kill you, and then whatever happens is what's going to happen, but I can't get past it. I can't. I'm homicidal, and I went to an AA meeting, and I was so crazy. You know what I mean? Like I just broke inside, and I was going, and Donald was the secretary of the meeting, and I was the cleanup guy, and all the other sponsees were around. I was so sick of these guys, you know, and my commitment started at 10:20 after the meeting, and it was like 6-something, and I showing up to the meeting, and I was just jacked, and I was going into the back of the meeting, and I knew somebody's going to say, what a loser, what are you doing here 4 hours before your commitment? And I was going to beat him to death. So I went walking right into the back of the meeting, and Donald Madden took one look at my face, and he ran up to the microphone, and he went, Earl! And I looked up at him, and he said, it's 6:22, and you're late. It's 6:22, and you're late. And you see what he did? He told everybody in the room, I wanted him. He's here because I told him to be here, so nobody'd get up on me, because he saw the condition I was in. And I just stood in the back of the meeting, and I surrendered. How did you know? How did you know me? How did you know what was inside me? How did you know how broken I was? How did you know I couldn't go another step? How could you know to save me? Why would you save me? I'm not worth anything. I really miss that gay fucker. Gonna need more. And when he died, I heard his voice in my head, and it said, you know, you're not allowed to walk the earth unattended, you little son of a bitch. You got a sponsor. So I got Al S. to be my sponsor, because he and Donna loved each other as members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just going to another guy who had a seat at the same table. And he sponsored me until I moved, and then I got Luther, the samurai, to sponsor me. Luther, a powerful dude, man. Luther's a powerful dude. Luther knows that the most powerful thing a samurai can do is sheath his sword. I made a commitment to nonviolence that I've kept for over 30 years. And if you're new, What I found here, once I surrendered, once I unclenched my fists and told you the truth about who I was and raised my hand and shared in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you what my first share was. My name's Earl Hightower. I'm an alcoholic. I got a job. I got a place to live. Things are going pretty good. Thanks. Shut up. And I had a one-bedroom apartment over a garage, right? And I lived there for 6.5 years so I could make my amends. I got a good job and a better job and a better job, and I just paid more and paid more and paid more until I paid up. It took me 6.5 years, paid off my amends, then went got a nice place to live. Who I got introduced to in here is me. Because I found this circle with a triangle. It's an ancient spiritual symbol. Stands for mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. And therein lies the balance that I've sought my whole life, and I've never had drunk or sober. Unity, service, and recovery is the same thing. Unity's the body. I bring it here. I couldn't get sober, but we seem to be able to. What's the first word in the steps? We admit it, we're powerless. And that's what I had to do, and that's what Donald got me to do, was admit that I was powerless. The second time I talked was when I was 2.5. Donald said to me, "Would you give me a cake?" And I was so, it was the honor of my life. And I said, "Yes, thank you." And we went to the Wednesday night wrist slashers meeting. Because that's where I fit in, man. And I gave him a cake, and he got up and he said, "My name is Donald Madden, and I'm an alcoholic, and the miracle of my life is that I'm sober, and who needs to know that is me." And he sat out. 6 months later, I turned 3 years sober, and I said, "Will you give me a cake?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And we went down to the Wednesday night wrist slashers meeting, and I got up and he gave me the cake, and he sat down. I got up and I said, "My name is Earl Hightower, and I'm an alcoholic, and the miracle of my life is that I'm sober, and who needs to know that is me." I went and sat down next to him, and he looked down at me, and he went, "Oh, that was wonderful." Oh, Jesus. And I just said, "You said that 6 months ago." And he said, "Oh, of course I did." So anyway, unity is the body, I bring it here. Recovery is the mind. I got to work the 12 steps to be relieved of the obsession to drink, or I'm never going to get comfortable sober. This ain't about stopping drinking. This is about how do you stay stopped. The only way I'm going to stay stopped is if I can be relieved of the obsession of the mind. So I work the 12 steps. That's what they're for. Step one is, what's the problem? Lack of power. What's the solution? Power. Step two, could a power greater than myself restore me to sanity? If that's the problem and the solution, what should I do? Well, do step three. Make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of a God you may or may not understand. Get out on your knees, do it, and get back up on the couch, you little bastard. Okay. Right. Now I want you to embark upon a plan of immediate action. Okay, what should I do? Well, 4 and 5 is you, 6 and 7 is God, 8 and 9 is everybody else. There's no one else to play with. Get on it! Alright, let's go! Where will I find it? It's in the book. Keep reading. Alright, moral inventory, very thorough. Oh, I'm good. Read it to another guy. He said, "Good luck with all that you got going on there." Yeah. 6 and 7, take it, God, no more deals, I'll remove the wrong stuff. 8 and 9, I made my list, very, very sorry, here's your money, back in the house. Pretty straightforward stuff. 10, 11, and 12, keep me in the game. 10, me, 11, God, 12, you. I continue to take personal inventory when I'm wrong, promptly admit it, because I've just scratched the surface. 11, I seek God through prayer and meditation. I pray for not God's... a knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And I meditate to quiet the mind so that when the answers come, I can hear them. Because they're there. The moral compass is there. Right? Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of working the steps. It's the whole point, to be restored to sanity, soundness of mind. Free for the first time since I'm 12 years old. Walking the earth a free man, no longer enslaved by alcohol and drugs. I can practice these principles and carry the message, right? But I got to do the deal. So unity's the body, I bring it here all the time. I stay with you. If you're new, stick with us. Recovery of the mind, work the 12 steps as outlined in the big book. Don't get any special charts going. Don't get any, don't go. Just get a book. For Christ's sake, get a book. Get somebody who's read it and have them take you through it. Doctor's opinion in the first 164 pages, for Christ's sake. You don't even have to read the whole damn thing. Just read the doctor's opinion, first 164 pages, do what it says, and it'll change your life. If you be an alcoholic of the hopeless variety like myself. Right? So I did that, and I get out of myself, and I'm a service to other people. That's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's how a life gets built. Right? So today my life is remarkable. I have an embarrassment of riches in my life. I do. Right? I travel the world. I'm married to a woman that actually knows me. It's not what I usually do. Been together almost over 20 years. Right? Different from my first marriage, which was for one day. I did. I got married and left after the reception. Well, I was very high at the time, and I thought, it seemed to me when I looked around that we had peaked. It wasn't going to get any better. So I beat this thing to death. She's a lovely girl. Let her go on with her life, right? I knew who I was. So I hit the road, and people said to her, "Where's Earl?" And she just said, "Oh, he comes, he goes." See, you got to stay with us. You got to find that it's not magic, it's footwork. You got to chop the wood and carry the water of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new. You come in and you find the people that got the light in their eyes, and you stick with them. You stick with the one that got the light. There's a lot of them in here. Right? There's people in here that have caught the buzz. Right? The big buzz. Right? The big buzz. Doing the deal. Right? Carrying the message. Practicing the principles. Love and tolerance towards others is our code. Which brings me to my final thought. I got a timer going here. What the hell's happening? Yeah. Okay, one last thing. And that's this. If you've been going in and out. You're damn right, uh-oh. If you've been going in and out, and you're here, you're back now because you're hearing that. Welcome. Get yourself a cup of coffee and a big book and have a seat. You are welcome here. And if I don't care if you've been out once, two times, 50 times, I don't care. If you walk through that door and say, "I'm an alcoholic, I need help," we extend the hand of AA. And you know that there's people that will look down their nose at you. There are people that will look at you and go, "Oh, look, he's back again." You know, I want you to go up to that individual and I want you to tell them this for me. I want you to go to them and say, "I've met a man named Earl Hightower and he said that you should go fuck yourself." We don't shoot our wounded around here. That is not what we do. When Dr. Bob gave his last talk, one of the things he talked about is we cannot get caught up in this fellowship, in the gossip and the innuendo. We can't be talking smack about each other. Love and tolerance towards others is our code, and it needs to start in here, toward each other. We need to be loving on each other, not talking about each other behind one another's back. If you're not talking to me, you're talking about me. Don't do that. I've had people had me drunk 5 times since I've been sober. Right? I was in LA. There were 5 rumors in 1 year. He's drunk. He's loaded. He's making pornographic films. He's very, very ill. He's moved to New York. And I got up at one of the largest meetings in AA, and I reamed him out. And I just said, "And I want all of you to know right now that 3 of those are absolutely not true." It was awesome. It was seeing people sitting there going, "Oh, he's not loaded. Doesn't appear to be in New York. Seems to be in good health. Oh, God. What's he..." If you're new, you have as much right to a seat in this room as I do, as anybody else does. You come here and you stay with us. because we love you for having the guts to walk into a room like this and take a seat. It's so hard. We know it is. And we commend you for it. We love you for it. Just let us, you know, put up with us until you discover that the love that we have for you, you're so worthy of. Just stay until you can experience that, okay? And I wish you the thing that is the hard thing for us to find. I wish you peace. Thank you.